Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Josh Rubner of the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, who explains why he believes President Obama's recent trip to Israel and Palestine will yield little unless the U.S. pressures Israel to halt settlement expansion. Retired CIA officer Ray McGovern, who reflects on the 10th anniversary of the Iraq War, and the legacy of the Bush administration architects of the war. And Seth Gladstone of Food and Water Watch, who talks about why his group is opposed to a recent agreement between environmental organizations and the energy industry that sets standards to make natural gas fracking safer. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the continuing battle over the future of the proposed Keystone XL pipeline, the U.S. Senate voted 62-37 in favor of a non-binding budget bill amendment on March 22nd that supports construction of the tar sands pipeline from Alberta, Canada, to refineries on the Texas Gulf Coast. Environmental groups who vehemently oppose the pipeline warn that the extraction and refinement of tar sands oil produces far more greenhouse gases than conventional petroleum. All Senate Republicans voted in favor of the amendment, along with 17 Democrats. Although President Obama has the final say on approving or rejecting the TransCanada Corporation's cross-border pipeline project, the Hill News website reported that Senator John Hoeven, Republican of North Dakota, is proposing legislation that would circumvent Mr. Obama's authority to decide the pipeline's future. Supporters of the pipeline say the project will create jobs and claim environmental concerns are exaggerated, while environmentalists maintain jobs numbers are overstated and point out that most of the oil that will be piped into the U.S. from Canada will be refined for export. In response to the Senate vote, Bill McKibben, author and co-founder of the climate change campaign group 350.org, asserted, "As usual, the ones who had taken the most money from the fossil fuel industry lined up to cast their votes. The co-sponsors of the bill, on average, had taken $807,000 in dirty energy money." McKibben went on to say, "The climate change movement is doing amazing stuff. We just need more of it. We can't outspend the oil industry, but we can out-organize them. In fact, we have to." The tabloid case of South African Olympian Oscar Pistorius, who allegedly shot his girlfriend Reeva Steenkamp on Valentine's Day in his home, quickly became an international media sensation. Interest on social media spiked again after the lead police investigator was removed from the case due to a pending attempted murder charge, and it was revealed that the athlete's aunt had worked as a murder suspect profiler for the police. The case, which highlighted celebrity, conspicuous wealth, and domestic violence, focused attention on the levels of violence in post-apartheid South Africa. Contrary to public perception, crime in South Africa in recent years has dropped and was below the level of a number of Latin American nations, including Guatemala and Honduras. When Nelson Mandela was elected president in 1995, South Africa had a sky-high murder rate of 65 per 100,000 people, which is 13 times the current murder rate in the United States. Since then, South Africa's murder rate has fallen in half, while disturbingly, the number of reported sexual assault cases is climbing. The high level of violence has been linked to South Africa's extreme inequality and 25% unemployment rate, where most of the nation's mineral wealth and industrial infrastructure is owned by the white elite. Today, it's only a 3-mile walk from Johannesburg's wealthiest suburb with its luxury homes to black slums with no running water or electricity. Low-income workers across the U.S. are increasingly on their own in the battle to win back wages owed to them by their employers. The news magazine In These Times reports state governments have slashed the staff of wage hour investigators in recent years. Ohio, Wisconsin, South Carolina, and Mississippi have cut the number of wage hour investigators in half. Virginia went even further last summer when the state laid off the entire division, reassigning all minimum wage investigators to other departments. Shrinking budgets have left wage enforcement bureaus hamstrung without the resources to uphold the law. Now, many unscrupulous employers are taking advantage of the lax enforcement to evade wage standards. Catherine Ruckelshaus of the National Employment Law Project asserted, "This sends a powerful message to employers that they're not likely to get caught, and that following the minimum wage laws is not a priority." Increasingly, business lobby groups like the Chamber of Commerce have tagged aggressive wage enforcement as bad for the business climate. This has led to a regulatory race to the bottom on the issue of wages, as states try to compete with one another by scrapping corporate regulations in order to entice companies to relocate. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
President Obama's recent trip to Israel and the Palestinian West Bank, the first of his presidency, was surrounded by low expectations, given that Middle East peace talks had been stalled for most of the years he's been in office. One of the highlights of the president's visit was a warmly received speech given at the Jerusalem Convention Center, in which Mr. Obama pledged unwavering U.S. support for the Jewish state, while imploring young Israelis to look at the world through Palestinian eyes and move their politicians to take risks to negotiate a path to establish an independent Palestinian state and a just and lasting peace. But during a brief visit to the West Bank, where he held a press conference with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, Mr. Obama pointedly avoided demanding a halt to the expansion of Israeli settlements on Palestinian land. Israel's continued construction of settlements, a violation of international law and United Nations resolutions, has been one of the main obstacles to renewing peace talks, where Palestinian leaders declare that they will not engage in negotiations until Israel freezes all settlement expansion. During his trip, President Obama reminded both Israelis and Americans of the two-nation special relationship that provides the Israeli government with more than $3 billion annually. But Israel is confronting growing isolation in the world community owing to the success of the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions campaign organized to pressure Israel to end their occupation of Palestinian land and grant the Palestinian people their fundamental right to self-determination. Your reporter spoke with Josh Rubner, National Advocacy Director with the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, who explains why he believes President Obama's recent visit to Israel and Palestine will yield little unless the U.S. pressures Israel to halt all settlement expansion.
I think Obama signaled very clearly to Israel and to the Palestinian people that all he is offering is rhetoric, and that Palestinians living under Israeli military occupation, living under continued settlement expansion, living as refugees who are denied their right to return, or living as second-class citizens within Israel, are now painfully aware that this is no longer a policy prior for the Obama administration. And for President Obama to throw his hands up in the air and say, well, this is a very difficult problem, as he did with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in their press conference, I think is quite disingenuous. I think it obfuscates the role that the United States plays in maintaining Israel's apartheid policies towards the Palestinians. President Obama didn't at all address the fact that it's unconditional U.S. diplomatic support and almost unconditional military support in the form of weapons that sustain and enable Israel to defy the rest of the international community and to perpetrate the types of human rights abuses that Palestinians suffer on a daily basis. So to throw up his hands in the air and to say, well, you all deal with it, you all resolve it, make your leaders do it, is quite disingenuous. What the United States should do, if it's serious about trying to broker Israeli-Palestinian peace, is first and foremost to end the U.S. military support and the diplomatic support that enables Israel to continue these policies that even the United States opposes.
Do you think there's any concern in the Obama administration that the legacy of his administration may be tainted by the fact that they are not really aggressively looking to restart peace negotiations and exerting pressure on both Israel and the Palestinians to make some concessions and changes here to make the possibility of peace real?
Well, I would put it this way. I think that Obama certainly has a lot of egg on his face because he made this huge priority in his first term and abysmally failed due to an incredibly flawed strategy for trying to bring these parties back together to the negotiating table. I think very clearly the Obama administration is signaling that for the rest of its second term, it's hoping to keep this issue as much as possible on the back burner and hope against hope that things don't boil over and will need direct U.S. involvement, direct U.S. attention. I think Obama, this was his farewell tour of the Middle East, this recent trip. And I think it was a clear indication that he's not willing to put the kind of political capital behind this effort as he did in his first term.
For a number of years now, there's been a new strategy employed by many of the Palestinians, particularly in the West Bank, on attempting to gain world attention and solidarity and support from people around the world by really focusing on nonviolent approaches to resisting Israeli occupation. Maybe you can give us a little bit of your thoughts on the progress and advancement of that movement and its effect.
It's a hugely significant development, and I think it's having a huge impact in the United States, affecting the discourse, changing people's perception of who is the oppressor and who is the oppressed. In 2005, more than 170 different Palestinian civil society organizations came together and issued a historic call for global campaigns of boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel and corporations that are profiteering from Israeli military occupation and apartheid. And since that call from Palestinian civil society, this BDS movement, for short, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, has really mushroomed all across the world. Corporations such as Veolia, the French multinational that does a lot of transportation and water projects, for example, has literally lost billions of dollars worth of contracts, primarily in Europe, because of their involvement in profiteering from Israeli occupation and apartheid. And of course, on the ground, you're also seeing weekly nonviolent protests in Palestinian villages that have been cut off from their lands by Israel's illegal wall in the West Bank, by expanding Israeli settlements, et cetera. And you can see that those efforts are really making waves with Five Broken Cameras nominated for the best documentary this year at the Academy Awards, which documents the struggle of this one West Bank village called Bilayin to protest Israeli aggression and apartheid policies toward this village. So, yeah, it's having a huge impact. It's changing minds, and it's very, very difficult for Israel to portray itself as the victim when they're acting so violently and so ruthlessly against Palestinian nonviolent protesters.
That was Josh Rubner of the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation. Learn more about the campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In a March 17, 2003 address to the nation and the world, President George W. Bush announced that he had ordered U.S. forces to launch America's long-anticipated war against Iraq. Live TV images of U.S. missiles exploding across the Baghdad skyline signaled the first phase of a war that its supporters predicted would last only a few weeks or maybe 6 months. But the relative ease with which U.S. troops invaded and then took control of Iraq's major cities was deceptive, given that America's so-called liberation of Iraq would trigger years of civil war that claimed the lives of up to 122,000 Iraqi civilians, 4,487 Americans with more than 32,000 wounded, many of them suffering lost limbs and lifelong disabilities. When the last U.S. combat troops withdrew from Iraq in December 2011, they left behind a shattered nation, still afflicted by daily sectarian violence, and millions of internal and external refugees. The war was launched in the wake of the 9/11 attacks in an environment of anger and fear. Playing on the American people's dread of another terrorist attack, the Bush administration justified its war against Saddam Hussein, claiming the dictator played a role in the September 11th attacks and possessed weapons of mass destruction, which posed a grave threat to the U.S., claims which later proved to be false. Your reporter spoke with Ray McGovern, a retired 27-year veteran CIA officer who had briefed Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush before retiring in 1990. Here, McGovern, who famously in 2006 challenged Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld over the administration's deceit about weapons of mass destruction, reflects on the legacy of the Iraq War and the lack of accountability for the Bush administration's war architects.
Long story short, after a 5-year investigation, the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Jay Rockefeller, releasing a bipartisan report about pre-war intelligence justifying the war in Iraq. It was a bipartisan report because Chuck Hagel and Olympia Snow signed on to it. What Rockefeller said is that the intelligence that was adduced to justify the war in Iraq was, quote, uncorroborated, contradicted, or even non-existent, period, end quote. Now I ask you, Scott, what does non-existent intelligence look like? Well, I'll tell you. Looks like forgeries, looks like made-up stories, looks like the stuff that Cheney and his minions prepared so that they could deceive the world and our Congress. And that's what really got me. I have this thing about our Constitution, okay? And I actually, like so many millions of others in this country, I took a solemn oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And, you know, when I saw, as we watched 10 years ago, 11 years ago, the profession of intelligence analysis being corrupted for the express purpose of deceiving our elected representatives out of their constitutional duty, their constitutional prerogative to declare or otherwise authorize war, it doesn't get any worse than that.
On reflecting about the motivation for the war in Iraq, obviously we have knowledge now that the stated reasons at the time, weapons of mass destruction, links with al-Qaeda, Iraq's intention to attack the United States was all out of nonsense. What do you think the real motivation in the Bush administration was to begin this horrendous, very costly war?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. Early on, I came on an acronym, okay? The acronym is OIL. Now, John Stewart made great fun of me after I used that for the first time before Congress. He says, McGovern, you're violating the rules for acronyms. You can't have an acronym, the first letter of which spells out what you really mean, McGovern. That's not fair. That's violating the rules. Well, I felt great about that because he was making the point that the most important was the first letter, O for oil. I for Israel. And L for logistics, the permanent military bases that we hope to emplace in Iraq forever and ever. You know, we didn't talk about permanent military bases. We talked about enduring military bases. Okay, that's, you know, sounded a little bit more endearing, I suppose. Anyhow, those were the three aims. Now, there are people who say, no, it wasn't about oil. I just don't have any patience with them. The Middle East wouldn't be important if it wasn't for oil and natural gas and water and that kind of thing. Israel? Well, no, the Israelis wanted us to attack Iran. Well, yeah, that's true. But Wolfowitz and Cheney and Rumsfeld said, no, we'll do Iraq first because they're the easier one. And the Israelis, of course, applauded that and cheerleaded for that.
There's been no accountability for the Bush administration that began this very tragic war, tragic chapter in our history. What should happen in terms of accountability for the men, the architects of this war?
Well, ideally, they should be brought before The Hague because some of the actions taken were demonstrably war crimes. Now, George Bush decided not to sign on to the International Criminal Court, and so that's apparently not an option. I think what citizens should do is what my friends are doing down in Dallas as they prepare for the opening of the Bush, well, they're calling it the Bush Library. It's really the Bush Library. They're going to get up and they're going to educate everyone in Dallas that they can as to what really happened. And meanwhile, we just have to keep the faith here and try to get the truth out. And with the Fifth Estate, with the web and with the Internet, there's a good chance that we can make an impact and console ourselves for the present with the thought, the real thought, that poor Bush, poor Rumsfeld, they can't even travel to Europe without being afraid of being picked up, imprisoned, and prosecuted for war crimes. Rumsfeld had to hightail it out of Paris 4 years ago when they found he was there. Bush had to cancel a trip to Geneva just 2 years ago when it was very clear that he was going to be prosecuted if he set foot in Europe. So there's small solace in that. It's terribly embarrassing to have a former president of the United States unable to travel to Europe. But at least those parts of Europe seem to have more sense of justice in the fact that people should be held accountable for the crimes that they commit.
That was Ray McGovern, a retired 27-year veteran CIA officer who later founded the group Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Visit our Between the Lines website, where you can find links to McGovern's recent articles on the Iraq War and other foreign policy issues. Some of the nation's largest energy companies have recently agreed to meet voluntary standards as they employ the method of natural gas extraction known as hydraulic fracturing or fracking in the Northeast. In fracking, large amounts of water and chemicals are pumped underground to break up tight shale formations and release the oil or natural gas within. If drilling and pipeline companies abide by 15 measures to protect the air and water based on an independent review, they will receive the blessing of the new Pittsburgh-based Center for Sustainable Shale Development, established by some environmental groups and the energy industry. Participants in the agreement include Shell, Chevron, EQT Corporation, Consol Energy, the Environmental Defense Fund, the Clean Air Task Force, and the Pennsylvania Environmental Council. Among the 15 standards in the agreement are limitations on gas flaring, maximizing water recycling, responsible wastewater disposal, and reducing the toxicity of fracking chemicals. One of the participating environmental groups, the Clean Air Task Force, applauded the agreement but said it's not a replacement for stricter state and federal regulations, which are currently lax enough to permit massive air and water pollution. But other environmental organizations are pursuing a ban on fracking and say collaborating with the industry is not the way to go. They cite growing public opposition to fracking, as seen in a March 20th Quinnipiac poll that found New York State voters opposed fracking by a 46-39% margin. Many of those surveyed said concern for the environment was more important than the promise of economic benefit. While New York State still maintains a moratorium on fracking, more than 6,000 wells have already been drilled in neighboring Pennsylvania. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Seth Gladstone, the Northeast Regional Communications Manager for Food and Water Watch, who explains why his group supports a total ban on fracking.
The bottom line here is that fracking is a process that is inevitably dangerous and harmful to human health and our environment, and no set of regulations will make fracking safe or healthy or acceptable. When organizations that call themselves environmental organizations go in concert with the fossil fuel industry to create some consensus, it really does a disservice to all of the harmed, affected communities out there that are resisting fracking to the best of their ability and urging our leaders to put an end to it, to prevent it from happening where it's not happening and to shut it down where it is happening. Because, unfortunately, there's no set of regulations, there's no technology out there that will make this process safe. And it's naive to think otherwise. I think it's naive to think that working with this industry, this fossil fuel industry, to create something that can be acceptable to these communities on the ground, I think it's foolish to think that working with these corporations, these are the same corporations, by the way, that have used their political power to force exemptions to current fracking operations from things like the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Healthy Drinking Water Act. These are federal regulations that are the cornerstones of our environmental protection. And the industry has succeeded in exempting itself from these regulations when it comes to fracking. And to think that they have our best interest in mind now is naive. We're talking about an inherently extreme and polluting process that blasts millions and millions of gallons of water and chemicals deep into the ground to crack rock and invade that ecosystem under the ground. This is inherently dangerous. It pollutes groundwater sources. It releases an awful lot of climate-changing methane into the atmosphere. And you have a number of connected consequences of this practice. Truck traffic, industrialization of our rural landscapes, car accidents, a whole host of issues that arise when these large-scale industrial operations come into our rural communities.
But Seth Gladstone, it is being done, especially in Pennsylvania. Do you see any advantage to making it safer as opposed to just outright opposing it?
Well, around the nation, we're seeing a growing movement to ban fracking. And the more folks learn about fracking, the more they're opposed to it. So we're not looking for stricter regulations. We're looking to grow the momentum around a ban movement. In places like New York State, for example, where this issue has been debated for a number of years, a steady, consistent stream of polling now shows that a majority of New Yorkers are opposed to fracking. They do not want this in their state. And we're seeing this movement grow across the nation in places where fracking has occurred, in places where it has not occurred. We're seeing movements in fracking states to enact local bans, municipal bans. So we're seeing a real groundswell of energy towards making this practice a thing of the past. There's no reason to undercut that effort talking about regulations when more and more people every day want it banned.
I did a major story on fracking in 2011 and looked specifically at New York, where there was and still is a moratorium. At that time, some polls showed more opposition than support for fracking, while others were the reverse. Has that opposition consolidated since then?
Without a doubt. With regard to the polling specifically, there are two polls that occur regularly in New York State that are sort of seen as the most comprehensive and most well-respected polls in New York State. And that one is a Quinnipiac University poll, and the other is a Siena College poll. And both of those polls now are consistently showing growing opposition to fracking and, in fact, majority opposition to fracking now.
That was Seth Gladstone, Northeast Regional Communications Manager with the group Food and Water Watch. Find more information on fracking's impact on the environment by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.